Good evening, everyone. Nice to see such a full room. I'm sorry to say that you're not all on vacation, but nice to see everybody here for the class. What we hope to do in this class is twofold. It's sort of it's part of the double entendre of the name of the series that we're doing of Between Tanakh and Sfarim Bashanah. That on one hand really is between the two classes, that we just finished the Tanakh Bashanah, which was really so successful, and they're looking forward to next year's Sfarim Bashanah. So just sort of in between, but also thematically, that what we're going to be doing over the next number of weeks is very much in between. We're going to be taking a look at the books. We'll talk a little bit more about this, that were written in between the time of Tanakh and in between the time of Sfarim, in between the time of what we'll call the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral tradition, the works of Chazal, the works of our rabbis. So before we begin, though, let me just say that anyone who hasn't had a chance yet to take Tanakh Bashanah, you probably can turn to one of the people sitting around you and ask them, should I take it? And they will readily tell you that you should. There's many people in this room who had a chance to take Tanakh. If you haven't had a chance to do it, do it. It's a yes. This is fun.
Well, they keep saying, please hang up and connect your call. So.
Okay, hopefully we're good. In any case, I hope that to anyone who hasn't had a chance to take Tanakh, we've gone to a lot of effort to try best to make sure that we can offer it again this coming year for those within our shul that haven't had a chance to take it, and that we're hoping also to sort of press forward in sharing this really unique and very special program with people who from outside of our community who haven't had a chance to take the class as well. So if you haven't had a chance to take it, there's forms outside to sign up. There's an early registration savings if you do so at this time. At the same time, for those of you who took Tanakh and haven't signed up yet for the Sfarim class, it's going to be fantastic. It's really going to be a great course working together with Dr. Schiffman from NYU. We're going to be looking at the most influential books written over the last 2,000 years in areas of Jewish law, Jewish philosophy, Jewish biblical interpretation. It's going to be excellent. It's really going to be a wonderful class. It's definitely going to make a major contribution to curriculum-based adult education learning within the Jewish community in Lincoln Square, but hopefully ultimately beyond Lincoln Square into communities across the country. So take a chance to sign for that. Again, those forms are outside as well. So we're going to be doing tonight, or over the next few weeks, is going to be looking at a number of books. Now, what's interesting is when we take a look and we think about Judaism, so obviously we think about Tanakh, and then we start thinking about Midrashim, Mishnayot, Gemara, and so on. Books that are written in the area of the 3rd, 4th, 5th century of the Common Era. Now when we think of Tanakh, so we think up to the period of the Torah, the receiving of the Torah, Har Sinai, the conquest of the land of Israel, the early years in Israel, the Shoftim, then finally the period of the kings, the breakdown between the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah, and ultimately into the destruction of the temple, and then even leading us past that period, into the period of the exile, the book of Esther, the book of Daniel, and then even into the very beginning of our return to the land of Israel for our, shall we call it, the second Commonwealth, the times of Bayit Sheni, the second temple period, with the early books of that time of Ezra and Nehemiah, perhaps at that time some other Sfarim were written as well, that perhaps refer back to earlier times, like, for example, Divrei Hayamim. All that was covered in Tanakh, but now we're not going to get into that so much now. When we think about that, we think about the period, so we're talking about that the books take us into somewhere into the 4th century before the Common Era. But then at that point, when we think about Judaism, we don't have any literature before the 2nd century of the Common Era. So So we're looking at a 500-year period where we don't have anything to look at and say, oh, this is Torah, this is Judaism. So one might get the feeling that, okay, maybe that was the Dark Ages, right? That was the Jewish Dark Ages. There was nothing written at that time. We're going to find that's not at all the case, that there was quite a lot written during that time period, some of which we've known for a long time, some of which we've only known of more recent times. And what I'd like to do is to take a chance to look at some of those works, to understand what they are, for those that perhaps maybe have heard of them but don't know exactly what they're all about, to know who wrote them, when did they write them. And then what I think is particularly interesting for our setting to discuss, and this is something which is often not discussed, even if you've studied these works in the past, is what contributions do they make to Jewish learning. And I think that's something which is particularly worth all to spend our time on, because if somebody has a chance to study these works in the university setting, so they may talk about these as historical books, but as Jews who study Torah, you don't necessarily in that setting get the chance to learn, well, does it actually have any meaning, does it have any impact on my Judaism, on my Jewish learning? So that's going to be something great to have a chance to study. Now, I'm just going to mention before we go on is that while we don't have any books that were necessarily written at that time that are part of our canon of Jewish religious working, it doesn't mean that we don't have any information within our Jewish writings about that time period. When one looks at the early writings, and in the Sfarim class we're going to have a chance to talk about them, of looking into the Mishnah, into the Medrash, into the Gemara, we very much do find references to things that take place during the time of Bayit Sheni, towards the Second Temple period. Whether it's referring to the rabbis that live at that time, many of the Tanaim that lived during that time period, Hillel and Shammai, so famous, they lived during that time period. We have many things that they have said that we have quotes of and stories of different people, of different kings, stories of the different kings of the Maccabees over their 150 years of rule in Israel, and different events that took place under the Romans that we do have written down in a later time in those books, but not necessarily things that were written at that time. What's going to be unique about the books we're going to be looking at is they, in fact, were written during that time period. So they're a little bit more of a primary sources in the sense that they're really almost more first-hand accounts, or more authentic almost of or reflective of that time period more than other things that we have. And what we're going to find is that it was not a dark ages for Jewish learning, for Jewish life. In fact, it was a very dynamic period. And we're not so much a history class that we're going into, but there are many different, there are Jewish learning going on. There's different types of Jewish learning on. There is Jewish controversy. There's debates. There's discussions. There's wars. There's battles. Meaning it's a very dynamic, it's a very rich time for Jewish experimentation, certainly the influences of Greece upon Jewish people. We think about Yavon, we think about the Mityat Nim, and so on, and the way that that spurred debate among the Jewish population as to how to interpret the Torah, how to understand the Torah. And so while the works that we have, that we continue to celebrate, are the books perhaps that reflect what survived, what ultimately became what Judaism is today, that time period wasn't necessarily, and something that we're going to be seeing, not everyone at that time believed what we've sort of, shall we say, accepted or continued to believe as Jewish tradition. There were Jews at that time who said, no, Judaism should be practiced this way, or Judaism should believe this, or Judaism should believe that. Ultimately, those traditions did not survive. And the tradition that we continue to practice today was the one group that did survive. That of what, in academic writings, of Pharisaic Judaism, that of the Perushim, that of the Pharisees. And we'll have a chance to see a little bit more about them when we talk about some of the other works. And some of the books we're going to look at, you probably saw on the handout, one particular is that of Josephus. So that'll be a good source to look at to sort of get a chance to know about Jewish life at that time. We think about a religious community's writings at that time. We're going to look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is a very new and very fresh area of academic study going on, and we'll talk about why it's so fresh if we've had them for already 70 years, but in fact it is a very new and a very fresh type of study that's going on. There's still many discoveries that are constantly coming out based on the studies of the Dead Sea Scrolls. When we think about law, we're going to look at Megillat Tanit, and that's going to sort of be the first reflection of perhaps rabbinic thought, and so that's going to be an interesting class. And what I want to talk about tonight is perhaps the words that we can't even read, that of the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha, simply they're hard to pronounce, but those writings are going to be particularly important as well. Why I chose to start with those is that those books are the most similar to Tanakh. I mean, these are the works that are the most similar to the writings that we find within the Bible, and so it would be interesting to get a sense to know what these books are, what made them unique, what's in them, who wrote them, and then ultimately a question that we need to ask is, well, why, if they're so similar to the books of Tanakh, why aren't they part of Tanakh? And that really brings then to the question of what are they? What are we supposed to do with them? Now, when we think about the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha, I have over here, if you want to get a good collection of the Apocrypha, you have to go to Christian sources, and we'll talk a little bit about that. This is the Oxford edition of just the Apocrypha, bought in Barnes & Noble. So it contains many different types of books. And just like when we think about Tanakh, and Tanakh has many different types of books. There's books in Tanakh that are histories, right? Things like Sefer Melachim, the Book of Kings. When we have things in Tanakh that are books of wisdom, like Mishlei or Kohelet, Ecclesiastes or Parables, right? That there we find a certain type of wisdom. We find those types of books in here as well. And we find in the stories of Tanakh, simply that, stories, episodes like the Book of Eov, and so on. We also find similar types of books in the Apocrypha that also talk about a story, almost a fantastic type of story. So we find the same types of writings that we have in Tanakh are the same types of writings that you find in the Apocrypha. And so they're interesting. Now, what's going to be interesting to us and something that we're going to explore is, because they're in at that time period, while they maybe haven't been adopted as part of our canon of religious studies, there in fact is a lot we can still learn from them, and a lot we can see from them that sort of helps us understand Judaism the way that we've sort of accepted it as well, based on things that were written or not written within these writings. And so it's an exciting area to study. There's certainly a lot to study, and we certainly can't even cover so much of it in a very short period of time that we have, but I'm hoping that it'll give you a little bit of a sense about this area of knowledge. It's a type of knowledge which you may have heard of in the street from Christians or so on, works that you've heard of, so it's good to just be familiar with them, but even more so to get a better appreciation of what they might mean to us as observant Jews. So the question is, if they're not part of Tanakh, these books, so where do they come from? Why do we even have them? So for that, I want you to turn to open your pamphlet to the first inside page, where we have a diagram. This diagram I got from Encyclopedia Judaica, and it shows the books that are found within the Apocrypha. One of the questions people had is, what is the Apocrypha? What is the Pseudepigrapha? The books, and what exactly is the difference between them. So in some ways, the difference between them is a thematic difference, that there are certain styles to the types of books that one finds in the Apocrypha, and a different style one finds in the Pseudepigrapha, but I would say almost more significant for the distinction between the Apocrypha and that of the Pseudepigrapha is not necessarily thematic. It's not necessarily that, oh, there are different types of books, as much as it is that some of the books, they're all literature from the Second Temple period, but some of those books became part, not of our canon, but somebody else's canon, and the other ones were simply literature of that time that have somehow made it through the ages. The books that became canonized, at least in some form or another, according to some Christian sect or another, are what are considered to be the Apocrypha, while the Pseudepigrapha are books that never became part of the set religious texts of any Christian sect, but continued to be handed down, continued to have been transferred over the years. Now, to some degree, there is a thematic difference, because Pseudepigrapha, to some degree, refers to books that claim to be written by one person, but in fact are clearly fabrications. There is a book we're going to look at, the Book of Jubilees. The Book of Jubilees, we'll talk a little bit more about in a second, is the story of an angel talking to Moshe on Har Sinai, and him talking to Moshe. Now, clearly, the book is not really written by an angel telling you what happened in with it. Moshe, it's pseudographic. It's something which is taking place later, but somebody is writing it as if that's the way it was written. Now, some suggest when you have a book that's written in that form, that they've written it in that way for the purpose of trying to get it accepted. You know, if somebody goes ahead and publishes a book and says, you know, this was something that Rabbi Soloveitchik taught, so all of a sudden it becomes an instant, you know, bestseller, because everyone wants to see what he said. Now, it could be he never said it, but if you say that Rabbi Soloveitchik said it, everyone's going to want to read it. So it could be that's part of why certain books are written in the name of somebody else, but it could be perhaps even more true that simply was a style. Like we have novels that are written today where it might be as a driven leaf, stories about Elisha ben Abuya, or stories about Rabbi Akiva, or so on, where a person writes it as if they're telling you, they were there, they're telling you this is what happened to Rabbi Akiva. It's not so much that they really are claiming they know exactly what happened or they were actually there, but it's a literary style. It's a way of conveying ideas, is by borrowing names of other people, you're able to sort of not say that that's really necessarily what Rabbi Akiva believed, but this is what I believe, but I'm sort of couching it within the framework of Rabbi Akiva to add a certain flair to the teaching. So it could be that's really where some of these writings come from and why they're attributed to people that didn't write them, but just simply maybe that was a literary style, that was a way of writing at that time, as some suggest, and again, we're not going to get into it, the Book of Eov, that maybe it historically didn't happen. It's a debate within the Talmud, but in fact, a way of maybe expressing certain philosophical ideas isn't simply to just go ahead and write a book of philosophy, but it's to write a story. And through that story, one is able to glean certain ideas, certain messages or philosophies from the episode, from the stories that take place. That's the basic breakdown. Those are what the books are. They're books that take place during the Second Temple period. They have all different types of writings, some of which have become canonized within the Christian Bible, some of which have not, none of which have been canonized by the Jewish Bible, none of which are part of the Tanakh. That's what it means, the Apocrypha. If you buy the Apocrypha, you're not going to find any books of Tanakh. If you buy a complete Oxford Old Testament Bible, so it's going to include what we consider to be Tanakh, plus these additional books in it. So just as an aside, when we talk about, or a person makes reference to the Old Testament is not simply insulting to Jews to maybe refer to Tanakh as the Old Testament. It's really incorrect. It's actually incorrect. The Old Testament includes books that take place before the birth of Jesus. That doesn't necessarily mean those are books that we consider to be part of our Bible. So the Jews do not believe in the Old Testament. It's not, we believe in the Old Testament, and they believe in that and the New Testament. We don't believe in the Old Testament either. We believe in Tanakh. We believe in the Jewish Bible. They've added on other things that they consider to be part of the Old Testament, but again, that's not part of our faith tradition. Okay. So, moving on, what I want to do, and there are so many books. I mean, within this alone, you can see there's 15 books or so. The Pseudepigrapha, I can show you a list of 40 books. It's a lot of collected writings. Obviously, we don't have time to get into all of them. So what I want to do is to take the chance to study a bit about a number of perhaps the more well-known of those books. Many of them have made a big impact on art. Some of them have had great art influence over the years, and some of the most famous paintings depict some of the stories we're going to talk about tonight. So I simply want to introduce you to some of those stories, and then what's going to be interesting for us to do is to do two things with those stories. One, I want to study them for the purpose of understanding perhaps why they weren't included into Tanakh, some of which will be clear, some of which will be less clear, just one second. And then finally, to talk about the type of impact that even while not part of Tanakh, those books still has on Judaism. Yes?
I just want to say that we were in Israel recently.
Yeah.
And in Caesarea, there's a museum that's really two museums.
Yeah.
They call it Raleigh, but it's really the Rakhinati Museum.
Okay.
And one of the museums has nothing but not so good old masters on biblical art, illustrating many of these themes.
Okay.
That these are in the Apocrypha.
And, well, and these are the artwork that were done at what point?
1700s.
Okay. Fine. Okay, interesting. Yeah, so, yeah, excellent. So, yeah, so definitely, there's been a lot.
It's worth going. It ain't great art, but it's worth
But in any case, some of these stories are so colorful that if you're an artist, you understand why these are stories. There's a lot of energy, a lot of certain types of overtones that flow through some of these stories. It's understandable why some of them have made it into the art world in such a profound way. So one of the things that we need to think about is what exactly some of these books are. So if you look on your outline, which is the front sheet over here, there's five books that I want to look at. Before we do that, though, just one quick thing on something that I just wanted to mention. We spoke about that some of these books are not part of Tanakh, so in fact, we don't have any references to these books within our Chazal tradition. You look into rabbinic literature, that of the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Midrashim, the Talmud. We don't have references. We don't even talk about these books at all. There are very slight references to some of them in a quite negative way, but again, not referring to them necessarily by name. There's one which is mentioned by name, the rest of them are not, but simply with the wave of the hand that we say these books are unacceptable. I want you to look at, in your source sheet, source number one. This is one of the primary sources. Yeah, you had a comment.
Yeah, I mean, that probably isn't unanimous in the door, because I remember it better. Remember things where they refer to texts which aren't in the Tanakh, they're actually in the
Yeah, so we're gonna talk about any of those, you know, sort of exceptions. But for the most part, they're not. I mean, you study Tanakh, it's about Tanakh. You study the Talmud, it's about Tanakh. It's not about these other books. And why is that? Why is that? So a very strong comment that comes from a Mishnah. So this source says, it says, Kol Yisrael Yishvam Pelech Lo'olam Haba. Every Jew has a portion in the world to come. Shnei Amar, Va'amach, Kulam Tzadikim, your nation is all righteous. Lo'olam Yirshu Aretz, they will inherit the land. Netzer Mata'ai, the outgrowth of my plantings. Ma'asei Adai Lifa'er, my handiwork with which to be glorified. Ve'elu She'en Lam Pelech Olam. Even though you're Jew, there are those, though, who don't get a portion of the world to come. Ha'omer Ein Tchiyat Hametim Min HaTorah, a person who says there is no resurrection of the dead. Ein Torah Min HaShemayim, that the Torah does not come from heaven, right? A person who denies Sinai. Apikoris, a heretic. Rabbi Kiva, Omer Rabbi Kiva says, Af HaKore Bisfarim HaChitzonim. Even the person, right, anyone who does want to get to the world to come should leave the class right now. Right, Rabbi Kiva says, even a person who reads these books. Now, which, when we refer to, if you look on your chart where it tells you the different books, so the way it refers to all of these books under the Jewish tradition is Sfarim HaChitzonim, the outside books, the books that are out, right? There's books that are in, there's books that are out. These books are out. You're not supposed to read them. Now, the understanding is meaning reading them for religious purposes, meaning reading them to just know what's there. That's a different. That's something different. But to read them for religious purposes, that's not what one is supposed to do.
There is also the term "metamias," like
"metamias." Yeah, that's about how the books got included. There's a whole discussion in Talmud how certain books get in Tanakh. Now we get into all the question of how the books that are in got in, and so on, and discussions about it. Here, I want to talk about the books that are out. In addition to that, so the question is, why are these books out? And that's something we're going to be talking about. But just one quick comment, look next below, this is the Gemara then commenting on that Mishnah, the Rabbi Akiva said, Avakori b'sfrei machitzonim, Tana, we have a teaching, b'sfrei minim, the books written by the sects, meaning the books written by those who are not part of our stream, our tradition, our way of interpreting, our way of understanding the Torah. And then later on we'll talk about Sefer Ben Sira, but clearly from these messages, what are they referring to when they refer to these books? They're referring to this. This is what they're referring to when they talk about Sfarim Chitzonim. And so they're very much, you see, very strong point that really, not only shouldn't you read it, but to the point that Kevin says, if you do read it, if a person does incorporate it into their religious lifestyle, that person does not get a portion of the world to come. But that is pure heresy. That's not part of our value system. And I assume it's part of going in the flow of that a person who's a heretic, they don't get a portion of the world to come. The point is that these books, perhaps, on Rebbe Kim's understanding, are full of heresies, and a person who incorporates the values or the teachings of these books into their religious outlook, they are a heretic, and therefore they don't have a portion of the world to come. Yes?
It's so interesting because I see Judith, and at the Jewish Museum, we have over 300 Hanukkiot that are Judith and Halitherinus.
We're gonna talk about that. We're gonna get into that, okay?
Okay.
We're gonna talk. Great points.
Because I'm really ready to go over there right now.
And burn it down.
Right.
Maybe we should. We're gonna get torches and.
I want to pour the water from here.
So we're gonna talk about that. So just quickly to go through some of the books. Quickly, what they are. We talk about Ben Sira, the wisdom of Ben Sira. That's a book which is very similar style to the book of Mishlei. It's a book of parables. This is not in your source sheet. This means more just talking on the outside. This is a book of parables. It's in here. It goes on for quite a bit. It's a book of parables, teachings, moral, shall we say, lessons. And it goes on, and it's very similar to the book of Mishlei. Some very beautiful teachings. That's the book of Ben Sira. Just to go through some of the stories, when we think about, I'll just read through the list over here, the book of Judith. This is a great story, and again, some of these stories we're going to have a chance to look inside. This story takes place during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, during the time of the attack on Israel at the end of the first temple period. There is a siege that has been placed around Jerusalem, and there's been a decision among the elders of the community that they are going to give up, that they are simply going to let the city fall to the Babylonians, because there's no way that they're going to defeat them, there's no way that they're going to get out of the siege. There is one woman, it taught her that she's an extremely righteous, an extremely pious woman. She is, and this is one we're going to talk about, she's a widow, and she's well-to-do. She's beautiful, she's intelligent, she's God-fearing. This is not me saying this, this is what the story says about her. And she says, she goes, let me go. She goes to elders, she says, open the gates, let me leave the city so that I can go, And it describes how she's wearing the black shrouds of the way that the widows would dress, and she changes into beautiful clothing, she does her hair, she puts on her makeup, she puts on her jewelry, she looks exquisite. She makes her way out, she goes to the camp, and she says, I have a message that I need to tell the general. She goes to the general, everyone who sees her, you know, their jaw is dropping, you know, as she walks by. She goes to the general and she tells him, she says, listen, we're doomed, you're going to defeat us any day now. She says, so I've come over to your side. Very happy about that, and that she basically throws herself at him, and he throws a lavish party. At the party, he gets drunk, one of the things that she tells him, she says, you know, I need to be able to pray every single day. And so every day, she says, I need permission to sort of leave the camp and to pray. And she does this for 3 days. She goes out, she prays, she comes back, going back and forth. Finally, on the fourth day, she goes after this lavish party, she goes into the tent with him, he becomes drunk, and when he finally falls to sleep, she takes his sword and cuts his head off. She then takes his head, wraps it up in some type of blanket. She walks out, people see her walk out, they assume she's on her way out. to say her prayers. They've seen her do it every day, but she keeps going right by. She goes to the gates of Jerusalem. There she presents the people of Yerushalayim his head. Everyone, you know, obviously gets cheers. They get ready. They get prepared for battle. The next morning, the people in the Babylonian camp hear the screams from the city of Jerusalem, so they quickly go to the tent of their leader. They knock. He doesn't answer. They go in. They find him dead. There's pandemonium. They start to retreat. At that point, the four Jewish forces unload from Jerusalem and are able to, at least at that time, defeat the siege. It's a very powerful story. It's a very beautiful story. It's about a pious story. It's about a righteous woman. And it's not part of Tanakh. Yes?
I just think it's interesting that the Hanukkah were all made at the time of Israel's independence. So Hanukkah reflect periods in Jewish history. And since the Jews were successful against the Arab armies, they were looking for other motifs throughout Jewish history.
Certainly the Maccabees has become major within the Zionist movement as a way to look to.
And also Judith and Halifax. And then there was a reappearance of her on Hanukkah with the women's movement in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So yeah, so we're gonna talk a little bit about that, specifically with its connection to Hanukkah. When, as I mentioned, when does the story take place? During the times of the Babylonian period, a number of hundreds of years before the story of Hanukkah takes place. The story of Hanukkah takes place in 165 BCE. This is taking place 600 BCE. And so that's something that we're going to need to look at. But in any case, the story is not part of Tanakh. Another story, and this is a great story, the book of Susanna. This is an extremely, it's just one chapter long. The story of Susanna tells the story again of a very righteous woman, a very beautiful woman, right? All the milas. There are elders in the community, and in fact, two of the elders, two of the great rabbis, they begin to lust after the woman Susanna, and they decide that they want to try to convince her to have relations with them. They go to her, and they find a time when she's secluded. She's out taking a bath, and her servants are away at that time. They go to her and they try to convince her. She refuses, and at that point they go ahead and they create a libel against her. They say, we are two elders and we testify in court. You need two people to make a testimony in a Jewish court. They said, we testify that Susanna was committed adultery. We saw her, we ran in. They actually say, we tried to stop the man, but he was stronger than us, he got away, and in fact she committed adultery. She's sent to be put to death. And then Daniel, maybe Daniel from Sefer Daniel, comes forward, and he's able to prove that, in fact, they were lying about what they had said. And in the place of her being put to death, those two witnesses are put to death instead. Again, a very, a very powerful story about religious values, about our law system overcoming those who have evil intentions and so on. Great story, not part of Tanakh. We made reference to the Book of Jubilees. The Book of Jubilees is basically a recounting of all the stories in the Torah up to the period of the giving of the Torah. Again, it's an angel talking to Moshe, and it's the angel telling him everything that's happened. And so it goes through all the famous stories that we have in the Torah. It talks about them, and in fact, it elaborates upon them. Again, in certain ways, very beautiful, very inspiring messages. Very much so not part of our Tanakh, not even a part of the Apocrypha. This is one of the books that you'll find in the Pseudepigrapha. That's an interesting book, particularly to study for a number of different reasons. Clearly, not part of Tanakh, and we'll talk about why that is. And then I'll say the last book that we're going to be looking at is the Book of Maccabees. Now, the Book of Maccabees, there's a number of different books of Maccabees. some of it written by different people. They're written around the year 100 BCE, after the period of the story of Hanukkah, but still during the reign of the Maccabees, and it tells the story. It tells the story of Hanukkah, it tells the story of the Maccabees. It's very inspiring. It's you read it, you really get a full sense, appreciation of the story of Hanukkah, clearly written by a very pious Jew, or a firm believer in Hashem, a believer in the Torah. Really, wonderful, wonderful book. Part of the Apocrypha, part of the Christian Bible, but again, not part of Tanakh. And then the question is, once again, why not? You know, why did these books become a part of Tanakh? Why are they not part of our tradition? And so that becomes something interesting to see, that while most of these books have very positive, have messages that seem very consistent with Jewish values, for whatever reason, they're not part of Tanakh. So one of the things that's interesting for us to study as Jews, is, well, why not? Why aren't these books part of our Tanakh? When historically speaking, we would say they certainly should be. They're great messages, they're the same time period. These books should be part of Tanakh, just like any of the other books in Tanakh have made it in as well. So what I want to do is to go through some of the stories with the time that we have remaining. I want to go through, this is where we're going to get into the sources, to go through some of these and to look at the stories a little bit more closely, and to start looking at different suggestions that have been made for why they haven't been accepted. And the suggestions are varied. There are many different types of reasons that have been suggested for all the different types of books, for why this one wasn't, why that one wasn't, why that one wasn't. I'll have a chance to see them, and let's talk a little bit about those reasonings. It's a great study. It's really, it's an interesting way of learning these books. And then finally, to then look at some of these books and to say, okay, they're not part of Tanakh, but you know what? They're on our Chanukiah, meaning some of these things are around. So what exactly is going on with that? Yes?
What about why were they accepted by the Christian Bible?
So I think why they're accepted by the Christian, so that's a great question. I think the reason why they are is because they're during that time period. Meaning, these are books that are, again, if I were to read it to you and give you a class, you know, slip it in the middle of the Tanakh B'Shanah curriculum, you'd be like, wow, that's a great sefer. You know, you'd be like, I never heard of that. Why? And then you say, oh, I didn't know about that other sefer with my last week either. So, you know, that doesn't prove anything. But the point is you would read it and you might say, yeah, that's a great book. So we understand why perhaps the Christians adopted it. Some of the books, certainly when you look in the pseudepigrapha, are early Christian writings. Meaning some of those are clear why they've become part of the Christian tradition. But even some of the books that are clearly Jewish, they're clearly Jewish books. They very much predate the whole Christian movement. They're adopted because they're books of great, they're beautiful stories, they're inspiring stories, and so they've adopted them as part of their tradition. And so the fact that they've adopted them isn't necessarily such a surprise. What's perhaps more of a surprise is why didn't we? Why did they become part of our Tanakh? Okay. So I wanted to go through some of these sources with you. So open up to your dailies. Looking back at the end of source number 2, we had a quote over here at the very end. We only read the first part. We spoke about Ben Sira. Ben Sira, as you mentioned, has many parables, messages, pithy lines, beautiful sayings. In fact, ironically, it actually is quoted once in a while in the Gemara, even though, as we're going to see, the Gemara says you shouldn't study it. So that's always interesting how it sort of, it clearly was a book that was widespread, even though it wasn't part of Tanakh, to the degree that it actually made it in at certain times into the Gemara. But it basically is not. It's basically excluded from the Gemara. And over here, that's where we have the statement in the second half of source number 2. It says, Rav Yosef said, the Sefer Ben Sira Nami Aser L'Mikre, it's also prohibited to read the book of Ben Sira. The Gemara doesn't elaborate as to why. Rashi says, I'm quoting him, Rashi says, because it's just the Hevel. Mm-hmm. He says because it's silliness, it's stupidity. In fact, the Gemara gets into a whole discussion. In fact, I take it back, the Gemara does get into a discussion about Ben Sira, trying to quote different lines and say, oh, that's ridiculous. And then it says, yeah, but we actually have a pasuk like that in Kohelis. And it's like, oh, but that line's ridiculous. And then it's like, yeah, but we've got something like that in, you know, in Mishlei. And it goes through until it finds it. What's interesting is a lot of things it quotes from Ben Sira are not in this Ben Sira. So it could be that there were multiple books, or maybe what was passed up. It's unclear exactly what's going on, but ultimately it seems to be that maybe some of the teaching, maybe some of the lessons in here, the rabbis felt were not the most profound teachings. Maybe they felt like, you know, somebody wrote it, you know, they had these great lines, but at the end of the day it was, you know, subpar, intellectual work. You know, it was written by someone who, you know, was maybe a popular writer. He wrote a few lines, but, you know, wouldn't necessarily consider them to be the most profound teachings. And so perhaps for that reason, that seems why the Gemara at least rejects Ben Sira as part of our tradition, why it wasn't adopted as part of Tanakh. Okay. I want to go on now. Now we're going to get into a little bit more substantive things. I'm going to ask you to help me read, because I don't want to continue to lose my voice. So I want to look at first in the story of Susanna. It's one chapter long. Starting halfway through with verse 36. So, someone volunteer to read the story? Okay, thank you.
And the elder said, as we walked in the garden alone, this woman came in with two maids and shut the garden door and sent the maids away. Then a young man, who there was hit, came unto her and lay with her. Then we that stood in the corner of the garden, seeing this witness, ran unto them. And when we saw them together, the man we could not hold, for he was stronger than we, and opened the door and leaped out. But having taken this woman, we asked who the young man was, but she would not tell us. These things do we testify. Then the assembly believed them as those that were the elders and judges of the people, so they condemned her to death. Then Susanna cried out with a loud voice and said, O everlasting God, that knowest the secrets and knowest all things before they be, thou knowest that they have borne false witness against me, and behold, I must die. Whereas I never did such things as these men have maliciously invented against me. And the Lord heard her voice. Therefore, when she was led to be put to death, the Lord raised up the Holy Spirit of a young youth whose name was Daniel.
Let's add, before you go on, some in certain editions, they actually amend Susanna to Sefer Daniel. They actually say, oh, this Daniel is Daniel from Sefer Daniel, and stick it on there as another chapter in that book. Okay.
Who cried with a loud voice, I am clear from the blood of this woman. Then all the people turned them toward him and said, what mean these words that thou hast spoken? So he, standing in the midst of them, said, are ye such fools, ye sons of Israel, that without examination or knowledge of the truth, ye have condemned the daughter of Israel? Return again to the place of judgment, for they have borne false witness against her. Wherefore all the people turned again in haste, and the eldest said unto him, come, sit down among us, and show it us, seeing God hath given thee the honor of an elder. Then said Daniel unto them, put these two aside, one far from another, and I will examine them. So when they were put asunder one from another, he called one of them, and said unto him, O thou that art waxen old in wickedness, now thy sins which thou hast committed aforetime are come to light. For thou hast pronounced false judgment, and hast condemned the innocent, and hast let the guilty go free. Albeit the Lord saith, the innocent and righteous shalt thou not slay. Now then, if thou hast seen her, tell me, under what tree sawest thou them companying together? Who answered, under a mastic tree? And Daniel said, very well, thou hast lied against thine own head, for even now the angel of God hath received the sentence of God to cut thee in two. So he put him aside and commanded to bring the other, and said unto him, O thou seed of Canaan, and not of Judah, beauty hath deceived thee, and lust hath perverted thine heart. Thus have ye dealt with the daughters of Israel, and they for fear accompanied with you. But the daughter of Judah would not abide your wickedness. Now therefore tell me, under what tree didst thou take them company together? Who answered, under an holm tree. Then said Daniel unto him, well, thou hast also lied against thine own head, for the angel of God waiteth with the sword to cut thee in two, that he may destroy you. With that all the assembly cried out with a loud voice, and praised God, who saveth them that trust in him. And they arose against the two elders, for Daniel had convicted them of false witness by their own mouth. And according to the law of Moses, they did unto them in such sort they maliciously intended to do to their neighbor, and they put them to death. Thus the innocent blood was saved the same day.
Great story. And it's a great story. So one of the things I want to look at is what's going on at the end. What's Daniel doing? So clearly he's showing that what? That they're lying. They're lying. Plenty more profound. What's Daniel doing? What's going on? What's going on with this story?
They were really the guilty parties, probably to begin with, or so they're...
Okay, fine. But what's interesting...
Is that the cutting to ocean party?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
The witnesses, they're bearing witnesses, and their stories don't jive one against another.
Right.
One said one part is true,
the other one said... But it's really in an insignificant matter. There's a whole discussion about what... and all these things, but there's a whole, and it's good that you ask more questions, there's a whole level of what disagreements they're allowed to have without impeaching their veracity for purposes.
Right, so we're gonna look at some of those things. I want to talk a little bit about the testimony that goes on here. Now, one of the things that we're clearly going to see, one of the questions is, we don't have a lot of these books in Hebrew, in part because some of them were not written in Hebrew. Some of them were written originally in Greek. Some of them clearly were written in Hebrew. And you can tell from the language because of the references they make to Hebrew terms that we're familiar with. And you're actually going to see that very clearly. I want you to look down at source number 4. This is taken from Sefer Devarim. And it says, Lo yakum ed echad b'ish l'chol avo. Right, that a person, what you cannot rely on one witness alone. L'chol chata, b'chol chata, asher yechata, al pi shnei edim. You need to use two witnesses. Only through the at least two witnesses can a matter be established as truthful. That you should have people come, right? They should come before the courts. And the judges shall scrutinize them, they shall question them. And it turns out that one that they were lying. Turns out that the witnesses were lying. And you shall do to him as he had intended to do to his fellow, or do unto them in such sort as they maliciously intended to do to their neighbor. Quoting from the book of Susanna. And you shall drive the wickedness, from your land. Everyone that's left should hear what happens, and they should not continue to do wickedness. Clearly, the phrase that you find in 26, verse 62 in Susanna is a direct reference to this pasuk that we find in Yud Tet in 19, that it's talking about the law of Edom Zomim, which is basically when you have a situation where witnesses come, they've testified falsely, that not simply is court adjourned, but you do to them as what their testimony would have done to the one to whom they're testifying against. And so if the person they've been testifying against would have been put to death based on their testimony, guess what? You put those witnesses to death because that's what they tried to do to somebody else. Right? That's the mitzvah of Edom Zomim, and that's what's being referred to within the story of Susanna. Now, what we need to do is to look a little bit more closely. We need to look at what the Mishnayot say, where they start to bear out more specifically exactly how the law of Edom Zomim is supposed to be practiced. Now, what I'm doing right now is not my own discovery. general, a lot of things I'm sharing with you are things I learned from graduate school from Professor Schneer Lyman. This particular suggestion for the problem is, in fact, is that historically very important because it was done by an individual known as the Maritz Chayot, Moreinu Harav Tzvi Hirsch Chajis, who was a rabbi in Europe in the early part of the 19th century, where he was the first person, we know, except for perhaps one sefer written in the 16th century, known as the Mor A9 from the De Rossi family in Italy. He starts, he's really the first, the beginning of a movement for Jews to actually care, to actually ask questions about these types of books. Prior to his time, you don't find rabbis asking questions about the Apocrypha, wanting to know why they're not included. He's really the very beginning of the Jewish intellectual movement, or the Jewish academic Jewish learning that begins in the 19th century. It's the first thing that we have on the books. The Maritz Chayot is found in the back of the Gemara. He has responsa, meaning in Yeshivot. He's quoted quite often. He's a respected individual. He's one of the first people to start this process of trying to do Jewish academic study. So he asks this question. This is his suggestion. He says, look at what this says in the Mishnah and Makos. It says as follows. Ena edem nasim zomim. Telling you, Enim Zomim is not any time there's some kind of conflict. You only become an Eid Zomim, Achizumu et Atzman, until they discredit them personally. You have to discredit not their testimony, you have to discredit the witnesses. How do you discredit the witnesses? Ketzad, Amru Ma'ida Anub Ish Plodi Chagret Ad Nefesh. He says, I saw, Yaakov kill Moshe on July 3rd in the Hamptons, right? We were there. We saw it happen. Amru Lahem, two other witnesses come and they say, Heech atem idem sha hare nerag o horeg o she nerag zeh o horeg hayimanu oto hayom makom ploni. They said, how could you say that? How could you say this person was killed? You guys were with us on the west side on Shabbos. There's no way. There's no way that you were out in the Hamptons and you saw it happen. You were sitting next to me in shul. So that's discrediting the witnesses, not what based on their testing, not based on what they said, but on them personally. So I take it back. I'll read it in English, just trying to get it right. It says, how can you testify when this murder victim or this murder was with us on that day in such and such place? Right? They say it doesn't count if they talk about the victims, or the person they said saw it happen to, right? If they say, we saw, you can't tell me this happened and happened because Yaakov and Moshe were with us in New York. Rather, what does your testimony have to be? Ella, aval amru lahem heichatem idim sharei atem hayitem imanu otem hayom v'makom ploni. Rather, they say not that the people who were killed, the people who were involved were with us, but rather, you guys were with us. You guys who testified that you were in the Hamptons watching this happen is not true because you were really right here in Manhattan. So that's a situation, Hare Elu Zomin. In that situation, they become Edom Zomin, V'neragin Al Pihav, and they are murdered. That's a case of Edom Zomin, where you testify that you've proved that the person who gave the testimony was not there. Not that you discredit the testimony that they gave.
So Danilo and Susanna held by my closet, held by another thing.
So let's look. So before we'll get in a second. So what do we say over here? So just continuing. So what about a situation where you discredit their testimony? It says in the next mission, it says, call the Marvin Vidigo and I raise them. The more questions you ask, the more you try to trip up the witnesses, the better. Echad Chakiros, Echad Vidigos, different types of questions that you ask. Bizman Shemachish and Zeza, Edusim Bitela. When they contradict each other, simply what happens? It's null and void. That's it. Everybody goes home. The only times Edom Zomim, or where you actually say that the witnesses couldn't have given their, couldn't have seen it because they were someplace else. That's a very specific area of Edom Zomim. The Maritz Chayot suggests that the reason this book was not incorporated into Tanakh is because it's wrong. It goes against Halacha. Because the story over there is that simply, they didn't say you couldn't have been there. They said you were there, but clearly you guys are lying. In that situation, according to the halakha, as we find it, they should not have been prosecuted. Now, as Jeff suggested, maybe you'll say, oh, it was a machlokis, it was a different time period. So you can either, different ways you can deal with it. You can either say, no, This is the halakha. That's the way the halakha always was. Or as, so, the Maris Chais wouldn't have said that. What some other academics over the past 100 years have suggested have said, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Maybe the story really did happen like this. But the problem is that now we paskin. We've paskined that a more limited way of Adam Zoman, and the story no longer fits into our halakhic worldview, and because of that, it wasn't accepted. Not that it didn't happen. Maybe it did happen that way. And maybe at that point that was acceptable. But because it's no longer acceptable, it wasn't accepted. Different ways of looking at it. But both of those ways are based on the fact that what we have as Jewish law does not work with the story of Susanna. Yeah.
Now, if you go to Dvorim in Yud Ches, in Yud Tes, and you read it literally, this seems to bypass that shot on Adam Zomerman, because it says,
right, yeah.
The Dorshu Hashokdim Heitev, the Hinei Eid Sheker.
Right, just some little line.
And then right after that, Vasisim Lokashazim.
Right, correct. The Pasuk is vague. The Pasuk is vague. It's within our Torah Shabbat Pet that it becomes a very specific situation. Absolutely. Yes.
Isn't there another problem that is they're not saying that she's married? Because the issue later on, we learned that if he's married, that that's not adultery in that way, because he had more than one wife.
She was married in the story.
Right, so then it's not adultery, so there's no capital crime for it.
Adultery is committed.
She's married, but not him. It doesn't say that she's married.
We didn't read the whole story. There's 35 verses beforehand. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, we did. Yeah, just let's skip over that. Yeah. Quick questions, and then we got to go on. Yes.
Do we know why the witnesses wanted to malign Susanna?
Because they wanted her to be with her, and she refused. That's part we skipped. That's part I told you. She refuses their advances, and it's a way of sort of getting back at her. It could even be she screams or something like that. And she screams, she called attention, so they quickly, change the story around and say, what had happened. Yes.
Just going to the general topic of aging, so we mean, in how many do we have instances where the false witnesses were really executed?
Yes.
We do have.
The Gemara quotes stories. We don't have, record keeping from that time period. The Gemara talks about stories. Yes.
Listen, we have stories in Tanakh that would go against the way we paskin now too.
Oh, so that's a good point. So you raise the $1 million question, is that join the club. Meaning we have other stories in Tanakh that seem to go against what we would say is halakha, and we either simply say they did it incorrectly, or we sort of ignore it, or we sort of interpret it differently. So we could have done that with this story also. So it's a hard question to answer. You can either say this one was too hard to get out of. I don't know. You raise a good point. Yes.
Well, just to sum up the objection, a lot of people have for sure. Okay, maybe this was not the way the mission eventually developed the law. This we don't exactly follow, but it obviously is not something from the meaning. These are not heretics. It was clearly this is definitely in Jewish tradition. So it's hard for me to believe that this is what they meant in the earlier quote when they said that if you read it's prohibited to read the books of the meaning.
Well, again, if you say this was, let's say, maybe the Tzedukim interpreted the law, so then that would be considered meaning. As far as the Prushim are concerned, the Tzedukim would be meaning. So maybe that could be meaning. That mean doesn't mean someone who is a different faith. A mean means a different sect. I mean, someone who's interpreting the Torah differently. So, in fact, they could have very well said, hey, they're interpreting the law of Adam Zoman differently than we do. Forget it. That's out. That's a suggestion. I want to look at another possibility to it. It's not so much on halakhic grounds, but perhaps on just inaccuracies, with the historical inaccuracies. This is another suggestion which is made. So it's a little bit out of the order. Skip to source number 10. This is taken from a Sefer Yirmiyahu. Now this fits well because it's talking about Galus Bavel, the exile of Bavel, and certainly if you say the story of Daniel really is taking place with Daniel, that means it's taking place during the Babylonian exile. So it says as follows: Vatem Shamu Devar Hashem Kol Agolah Sher Shalach Yishlaim Bavel. Right, listen to those who have gone to Bavel. Komar Shem Tzavakot El Kei Yisrael El Achav Ben Kuliyah El Tzidkiyahu Ben Maasiyah. He says to two men, Achal, the son of Kulia, and Tzidkiyahu, the son of Maasya. Hanevi'im lachem bishmi sheker. He says, you guys have prophesied, you've lied to your prophecy. Hini noten atem biyad nebuchadnezzar, retzar, melech babel, bechacham, le'enechem. So therefore, I'm giving you over to Nebuchadnezzar. Read the translation. And of them shall be taken up a curse by all the captivity of Judah that are in Babylon, saying, the Lord makes thee like Zedekiah and like Achav, and the king of Babylon, roasted in the fire. Yan asher asu nivala b'Yisrael, v'inafu et nishay re'ehem, v'idaru d'var b'shmi shekar, asher lo tzivitim, v'anuchi hayodea v'ad ve'ed nu'um Hashem. Because they have wrought vile deeds in Israel and have committed adultery with their neighbor's wives, and have spoken words of money falsely, which I commanded them not, by him he that knoweth, and a witness, says the Lord. So these two men, what have they done wrong? What have they done wrong?
Adultery.
It talks about they committed adultery. What else does it say they did?
False prophecy.
False prophecy. If you look in Tanakh, we don't have any reference to these two men doing anything related to adultery. So some suggest that who are these two men? The two men in the story of Susanna. That in fact, in the story of Susanna, they had attempted to commit adultery, and then this story referred to is actually taking place afterwards, that they then in addition give false prophecy. And who puts them to death? Not the rabbis because of their adultery, but rather they're put to death by the king of Babylonia. That's who puts them to death for what they for their lies. And so it's simply saying it's not that the story's not true totally, meaning they were put to death. But we didn't put them to death. They weren't put to death by the rabbis. In fact, they were put to death by somebody else. And so the suggestion for that, perhaps, is that, forget the halakhic grounds, perhaps the story of Susanna is just a little bit historically inaccurate. That's not exactly what happened. And because of that, it wasn't included into Tanakh. So it's a suggestion.
Why are they? What is the connection between these two people and the people who refer to the story of Susanna?
It could be that they're the very same people.
Why? Why do you make that connection?
So the suggestion is it's taking place at the same time period. The story is supposed to take place during that exile. This is taking place during the exile. It refers to two men who attempted to do adultery. This is a story about adultery. And so just sort of putting it together, some suggest that maybe these are the same people. It's no ironclad proof. It's no ironclad proof. That's a suggestion. It just sounds, how many stories do we have in the Bible? It just sounds so similar that it seems like, yeah, okay, that's probably the same people.
It's a very thin thread of
it is. Right? There's no ironclad proof. It just sounds similar, but it's not a full blown proof. Okay, let's move on. Let's go on. Let's look at the story of Judith. For this, I actually want to discuss with you. This is a complicated one. This is a story that we've spoken before, but let's just read it inside. It's worthwhile to see some of it. Can someone volunteer to read, please? Someone? Do we have any readers? Yeah, great, thank you.
Now at that time, Judith's first girl, which was the daughter of Merari,
so then, can everyone hear in the back?
No.
It's a lot. I'm going to just choose someone in the middle section. Can someone from over here read, please? Oh, we're all adults. Thank you.
Have her come here.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now at that time, Judith heard thereof, which was the daughter of Merari, the son of Ox, the son of Joseph, the son of Ozel, the son of Elsiel, the son of Ananias, the son of Gideon, the son of Ephraim, the son of Abuzo, the son of Eliud, the son of Abiel, the son of Nathanael, the son of Samael, the son of Salas, Gal, the son of Israel.
Wow.
And Manasseh was her husband, her tribe and kindred, who died in the body of Christ, where he stood. should always remember that while she was in Judah, they had committed adultery and fell on his bed and died in the city of Jerusalem. And they buried him with his fathers in fields between the Chinese and the Lama. So Judith was a widow in her house 3 years and 4 months. And she made her tent on the top of the house and put on the top of it on her bones and there her widow.
Yeah, keep going.
Now, when the evening was come, the servants made haste to depart. And Boaz shut his tent without and dismissed the waiters from the presence of the Lord.
So just take a skip, right? I mean, the first part was just a description of her, how pious she was, a little bit of her history. We're now skipping forward. There's the siege. She's now gone. Already the story. She's gone over to their camp, and she's already made acquaintance with the general.
And her furnace lying upon his bed before he was filled with wine. Now Judith had commanded her maid to stand in the narrow bedchamber and to wait for her coming forth as she did daily. For she said she would go forth to her prayers and she stayed to the Lord for the same purpose. So all went forth and none was left in the bedchamber, neither little nor great. Then Judith, standing by his bed, said in her heart, O Lord, God of all power, look at this present upon the works of my hands.
There's just a little bit of excerpts about Judith. Again, it's a great story. If I were to ask you, does this story sound familiar? You'd probably say, yeah, it sounds really familiar. You probably quote a few stories in Tanakh that echo similar episodes. Yael, right? Story of Yael. Right, Yael is the one great. Who else is a similar type of heroine? She goes to the king, right? Esther, right? It's very much like Esther type of story, right? The similar type of theme sort of fits into the genre that we have within Tanakh. He would say, oh, it's a great fit, you know, into the rest of the stories. So, again, with all of these, we don't know for sure the different suggestions. So some suggest, and it's unclear even within Jewish tradition what the value is, so it's really not clear. And one of the things that the story makes very clear about Judith in her personal life is that who is she? She's a widow. And not only she's a widow, but she remains a widow by choice. She has those who want to marry her, and she decides, I'm going to remain single. In Jewish sources, there is a debate that goes on, not about Judith, but just in general, as to the value of marriage and the discussion of widows remaining single or getting married again. Some say absolutely, meaning that's a way, and that's sort of the way that Judith in the story sort of expresses it, is that's a true show of admiration, a true show of respect for your former spouse, the fact that you continue to remain single and say that, no, I had my husband, I was married, and at this point forward I'm going to remain single. There are other sources that seem to imply the opposite, that say, no, a person should remarry. That's what a person's supposed to do. We're not supposed to be single. We're supposed to be married and sort of go on in that way. So some say those who take that opinion about a Jewish value system say, so this book goes against the Jewish value of importance of marriage. And since it goes against the importance of Jewish marriage, that's why it wasn't included in Tanakh. It's debatable. It's debatable within our tradition whether what that value is. So whether or not that would be a meaningful reason to exclude this book is debatable. But certainly, just the concept of marriage is a very important idea within Jewish tradition. So could it, in theory, if someone truly strongly believed that everyone had to make sure they were married, think that a book that sort of celebrates being single, feel that therefore it shouldn't be part of our tradition? Maybe. Controversial topics. But anyway, that's some of the discussion that's had within the writings about why this book didn't become a part of Tanakh. Yes.
I know we're short of time and maybe I'm reading this question too early, but it seems to me that there's a big jump from saying you're not canonizing this book and someone suggesting that if you read this book, you think, okay, we'll go along the line.
So again, some of the books have more clear heresy than others. This book you'd have a hard time, right? This book you'd have a hard time finding heresy there.
Yeah.
Right, absolutely. But again, it could be, again, if it's books written, if you believe it's a book written by a sect, so that could be, it's a good point. I'm not, it could also be that everything would just sort of wrap together, too. You know, it's sort of meaning, this is a certain genre of books. Many of them are heretical, so they all become prohibited to read. I mean, there's really two questions. One is, why are they not part of Tanakh? And then the second question is why are they even prohibited to read at all? As the Gemara goes on to say, not everything that's not Jewish becomes prohibited. It says, you know, the Book of Homer is a person is allowed to read. So, meaning it's not excluding any type of book that's not Jewish. It's excluding certain types of books. So you raise a good point. Take one more question, and we really need to go on.
Is it possible that the reason is because at the time when they say it was written by sects, and the Purushim at that time were trying to establish themselves as the leader, especially after the Korban Beis Hamikdash, so that they came down very hard.
Yeah, very much
on,
so.
On anybody who was, you know, who wasn't from them.
Yeah, absolutely.
They had to establish.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very reasonable. Meaning, this was it. They needed to establish that this is the way. It was very, you know, sort of create boundaries.
It was written by someone else. So
yeah, it's definitely a possibility. Fine, let's go on. I want to look at the book of Jubilees. Because this is really interesting. The Book of Jubilees is, again, that angel talking to Moshe and telling him, you know, this is what's happened. And it starts from creation and goes all the way through. So just as the Source 11 says, looking at Source 11, we're going to look at a number of contradictions. So what does it say in Source 11? Abraham loved Jacob, and Isaac loved Esau. Abraham loved Jacob, but Isaac loved Esau. What does it say in the Torah? Vayav Yitzchak et Esau, Kitzayiv. And who loved Jacob? Rivka. So the Book of Jubilees says Abraham. Tanakh says, Torah says Rivka. It's one. I don't know, profound distinction, but meaning it's different, right? It's an incorrect phrase being used over there. That's one example. Let's look at another one. This is a more profound religious one. It says their bones. This is Source 13. Their bones, Jubilees. Their bones will rest in the earth, and their spirits will be very happy. What does that seem to say? You die, you're dead. Your soul goes on. But you are dead. What does it say in Yechezkel? Thus said the Lord God to these bones, behold, I bring a spirit into you, and you will come to life. And so, it's sort of, the Book of Jubilees seems to be rejecting Tchiyas HaMeizim, seems to be rejecting resurrection of the dead, while within our tradition, that's something that we much believed in. As we saw earlier, rejecting resurrection of the dead is a reason to not get the world to come. So that would be a very good reason to say that the Book of Jubilees should not be part of Tanakh. What I want to say is perhaps an even more overwhelming reason. This is a broader reason for why the Book of Jubilees is rejected. Is based on the next source. This is taken from chapter 6. There it says, "Now you command the Israelites to keep the years in the number 364 days. There will be people who carefully observe the moon with the lunar observations because it is corrupt." Wow. So what are they saying? What type of calendar should we follow?
So
again. The whole Book of Jubilees is called Jubilees. It's constant counting. Seven, the years, the dates, the whole basis of it is the solar calendar. And it's fitting in all the events in Tanakh. I mean, it's actually really interesting. It fits in, you know, all the biblical stories into important historical dates. You know, it's like, Avram did this on the day of Sukkot, and Yitzchak did this, and it was Pesach. Meaning, they sort of work it all together, but it's all based on a solar-based calendar as opposed to the lunar-based calendar that we follow. So based on that, it's clear why this book would have been rejected. This is clearly written by a sect very much other than the Purusha, because they're following a different calendar. It's totally beyond. We're going to have to talk about calendars in future weeks, but this book is clearly out for very obvious reasons.
The Essenes in the Dead Sea Scrolls used the solar calendar.
Right, absolutely. So it could be that's part of where this book comes from.
Don't we use
a combination? No, we follow a lunar calendar. Americans we follow, okay. I mean, religiously, it's everything lunar. Okay, so that's some of the reasons that are suggested for some of these books. Another suggestion which is made for why some of these books are not included. Again, we spoke about language, and then most of the books we have are come to us in English. Maybe we have a Greek or a Latin, you know, rendering, you know, of these books, but we don't have them in the Hebrew Aramaic. Some of them is because it simply was lost, meaning it originally was written in Hebrew or Aramaic, but because it wasn't canonized for Jews, it ultimately was not a language accessible, and it was translated, and that was just the originals were lost, some of which were found in Qumran. Some of them, though, were originally written in Greek, meaning the language is clearly not a language of our tradition. And so for those books, that would probably have been a reason enough for them not to have been included in Tanakh either. So that's something, you know, as well. Yeah.
It seems, forgetting about everything else as to why these were not canonized, once you stopped at Ezra and Nehemiah, there's nothing after that. If they would have chosen one book here and not a book here, then it would have been very, you know, then we would have looked at it even in
the
strange.
Well, even during the times of Tanakh, where there's references in Tanakh to other books, there's Sefer, Milchamot, Hashem, and I don't know them all about it. You can ask someone who really knows. There's a whole list of books mentioned in Tanakh that are not part of Tanakh. So the fact that not every book that was there is included is not necessarily a reason. But you do raise a good point. That's what I want to get onto now, is the issue of dating. And the issue of the date of the canonization of Tanakh, which again won't necessarily help us for books that were written that were really very old, but books that are newer, because one of the books that is not included is what? The Book of Maccabees. The Book of Maccabees is a great book. Why isn't the Book of Maccabees part of Tanakh? So it could be based on something else. The question is when is Tanakh closed? And it could be that there was an official closing of Tanakh, and from that point forward, it doesn't make a difference how good of a book it is. It could be a bestseller. It's not making it in. It doesn't make a difference what it is, who wrote it, even if it's the most beautiful, the most uplifting. Even if Hillel wrote the Sefer, it's not going to become part of Tanakh because it's after the close of Tanakh. So that really then raises the question is when is Tanakh sealed? When is Tanakh closed? So look at this next source over here. Let me tell you what you think. This is from Psachim. It says, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, this is source 16. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Yeshua ben Levi said, Asherim ba'arba taniyot Yeshua anshei Knesset Agadol ha'kotvei svarim tefillin u'mezuzot. The anshei Knesset Agadol, the men of the Great Assembly, made 24 fasts over those who wrote scrolls, shelo yitashru, that they should not become wealthy. She'el mali mitashrim ein kotvis. Because if those men become wealthy, they'd stop writing. And so they wanted to ensure that there would be an abundance of Jewish text, so that perhaps it would preserve our tradition properly. And so they prayed that they should not become rich. Interestingly, and some suggest, how many fasts does it say they made? 24. How many books of Tanakh are there? 24. It could be the Anshei Knesset Agadol, they're the ones who set it at 24. The Anshei Knesset Agadol, they say it's 24. These are the books that are in. From that point forward, the rest is out. So the question is when is that? When is the Anshei Knesset Agadol? So we know it's sometime during the second temple period. They're during the first part of Bayit Shevi. So look at what it says in Masechet Avot, in Mishnah Avot. So it says, Moshe Kibel Torah B'Sinai, Source 17. We're going to go a little bit over. If anybody wants to leave, you're free to go. Moshe kibel Torah from Sinai. Moshe accepted Torah from Sinai. Masor Yeshua gave it to Yeshua. Yeshua gave it to the Zekanim. The Zekanim gave it to the prophets. The prophets gave it to the Anshei Knesset Hagedola. What does the next thing say? Next Mishnah. Shimon Hatzadik Haya Mishayrei Knesset Hagedola. Who? He was the last remnant of the Anshei Knesset Hagedola. So if we want to say the last point possible that it could have been set, assuming it's set by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, when is that? Shimon HaTzadik. When does Shimon HaTzadik live? It's a question. It's a question. We're probably around the year 200 BCE. 200 before the Common Era. Assuming that's true, anything written after 200 BCE, doesn't make a difference how great it is. Maybe it's Hebrew, doesn't make a difference if it's pious, doesn't make a difference if it's uplifting. It's not part of Tanakh. Tanakh has been closed. Now, why the Anshei Knesset HaGedola felt it important to close Tanakh at that point is a broader question. It could be that that is the time of when there becomes more Greek influence in Israel. That's when that seems to be when the Seleucids take control over Israel. Ultimately, from the Seleucids will come Antiochus. So it could be that period. They thought, you know what? It needs to be sealed. It needs to be done. Maybe you want to say it's a little bit earlier. We know Alexander the Great comes in 332. Maybe already at that point they seal it. Meaning, at a certain point they feel it needs to end. Now, an additional reasoning is also part of the Jewish tradition as to the end of prophecy. The next source talks about the end of prophecy. We know, we believe that there were prophets who were part of Anshei Knesset HaGedola, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, but they were the last of the prophets. So it could be, again, that anything that's written during times of prophets can be considered to be infused with godliness, can be considered to be godly works. However, anything written later, maybe written by a great rabbi, maybe written by wonderful people, but it's after the times of prophets. It doesn't contain prophecy, and therefore, that's why they're not included in Tanakh. So while we read these books, and we don't necessarily see the difference between them, simply speaking, if they come after a certain period of time, we don't believe in prophecy anymore. They're not going to become a part of Tanakh. Okay, so that's different reasons. Many different reasons. Some halakhic, some historic, some for language, some for dating, some for values. Many different reasons are suggested for why the various books do not become part of Tanakh. What I want to look at now with the next few minutes, and again we're going to go over just for a few minutes, is the fact that while they were not part of Tanakh, some of them seem to creep their way in. Some of them have had some lasting influence. What I want to look at is certainly our history of Hanukkah is based on the Book of Maccabees. Look in source 19. This expresses very clearly what happened. It says, and the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, that everyone should give up their religious usages. Furthermore, the king sent letter by hand by messengers to Jerusalem, to the cities of Judah, to the fact they should practice customs foreign to the traditions of the land. And they should cease sacrificing, they should profane the Sabbath, they should leave their sons uncircumcised, so they might forget the Torah. And whoever should not act according to the word of the king should die. And in fact, the next source quoted here, in fact, says that people were put to death because they observed the Torah. So, the Book of Maccabees certainly is a book that we've continued to look at as a book of history. Maybe not as a book of religious value, but as religious Jews, if we want to know what took place during the story of Hanukkah, the Book of Maccabees is a great place to go. It's clearly written from a religious perspective, and so it's a great source. What's interesting is that while the Book of Maccabees was not read over the centuries, there was another book that was read. There's a book I actually have quoted in here. It's called Megillat Antiochus, the Antiochus Scroll. And this is unclear exactly when this scroll was written, but it seems sometimes during the end of the period of the Talmud. Let's say 5th, 6th century of the Common Era. And this book, in fact, was read during that period of the Gaonim, during the Middle Age period, and so on, as a book that people would read. In some communities, it was even read in shul, like we read the Megillah on Purim. Maybe not with a bracha, but it was read publicly. Because this was, the stories in here are based on the Book of Maccabees. So while we didn't read the Book of Maccabees, the Book of Maccabees did make it into our tradition through Megillat Antiochus. So that's one sort of encroachment into Judaism that we have. Another interesting one is Judith. As Linda mentioned, in art you find it a lot. In fact, in Judaica, you find Judith. Jewish feminists love Judith. So why is that? Why Judith? So if we look in the Medrash, this is Otsa Midrashim, this is a later collection of Midrashim. In fact, we have the story quoted. Just to look, what are the first words? The rabbis taught in the days, this is 21, source 21, in the days of the wicked Greek Empire. The during times of the Greek Empire. So, could it be that there's a question when the book of Judith is written. Some, in fact, say the book of Judith is actually written after the story of Hanukkah, even though it talks about a story that took place during the king of Babylonia. They want to say it, in fact, was perhaps written as a celebration, not of a person named Judith, but of a person named Judah. And then, in fact, maybe not historical, but that she was sort of the heroine person, written, glorious stories were written about her, which maybe would say why it never became part of Tanakh if it wasn't historically accurate. But one suggestion is maybe they wrote it about Bavel because they didn't want to ruffle feathers. Maybe it really was a Hanukkah story. Maybe it really was a Hanukkah story. It got written down into the Apocrypha as a Bavel story, but it could be we continue to have a tradition that it was during actually the story of Hanukkah. And in fact, it's even made it into halakhic literature for the way that we practice, the way that we celebrate Hanukkah. Look at source 22. This is the Shulchan Aruch. He says that additional meals are voluntary, talking about Hanukkah, as they did not establish them for feasting and joy. The Hanukkah was not a day set aside for meals. Rabbi Moshe Israel still writes in the Haggah, and there are those that say there is a bit of a mitzvah of increased meals, because during those days was the dedication of the altar, as we know, after the victory. And there is a custom to say songs and praises during those increased meals, and then they are mitzvah meals. There are those that say one should eat cheese on Hanukkah, because the miracle was done through milk, which Yehuda fed the enemy. Look in the Mishnah Berurah. This is in the last century being written. This is the Chavetz Chaim, Shlomo Meir Kagan. He says, she was the daughter of Yochanan the high priest. That's who she was. And there was a law that all engaged women was of intercourse with Tafsar first, Tafsar being the name of one of the people there. She fed cheese to the siege's general when drunk and cut off his head, and everyone escaped. And so somehow this story, in fact, has made it into our tradition, almost canonized as part of our celebration of Hanukkah, that Hanukkah, part of the victory of Hanukkah, was through the woman of Judith. Clearly, the Judith of the Apocrypha. So that book sort of did make its way in, because it's really true, and it therefore became part of our tradition. What I want to look at now is that just one other thing. And this is not so much where the story became part of our tradition, when in fact, if you look at that book, you in fact see something important towards Jewish learning. This we're going to conclude with. There's a story in the Torah that says, source 24, and the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and curse him that curses you. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you. Right? That's a quote from the Torah. Now, when we think of Abraham, what do we think of the stories of Abraham? Think of his youth. What do we think of? He smashes the idols. Abraham is what? What else do we know about Abraham? He's the first monotheist. Right? It's nowhere in the Torah. Those stories are not in the Torah. Those stories are found in the Midrashim. Now, Midrashim are written, we're going to find out in Sfarim Bashana, let's say the 4th, 5th century. Okay? Look at the Book of Jubilees. The Book of Jubilees is written in the 2nd century before the Common Era. And the child Abraham, this is source 25, and the child Abraham began to realize the errors of the land, that everyone was going astray after graven images, and after impurity. And he began to pray to the Creator of all, so that he might save him from the errors of mankind. Why does he need to be saved? He's been thrown into a fiery furnace, I don't know. And he said to his father, what help or advantage do we have from these idols? Worship the God of heaven. And his father said to him, be silent, my son, lest they kill you. So we actually find in the Book of Jubilees is already the first inklings of Midrashim. Now it's not to say necessarily that the rabbis were reading the Book of Jubilees, and that's where they got their Midrashic interpretations. But what it does mean is that the Midrashic interpretations that maybe are only written down in the 4th century are not invented in the 4th century, but in fact those Midrashic teachings in fact had been around for hundreds and hundreds of years already. They just weren't written down because we didn't start writing things down until after the destruction of the temple. That's a discussion, why not? In the book of Jubilees, they already wrote it down because they did write down these teachings. And so we actually see from the book of Jubilees that in fact part of our oral tradition is quite old. It's quite old because it already appears in these earlier writings. And so that's an important appreciation to have, that sometimes, you know, we think of, oh, you know, they just made this up. Maybe they did, but they made it up. They made it up much earlier. It's a much older story. These are much older traditions that we find in the Medrash, find much earlier than the time when the Medrash in fact is written. And so that's sort of the end of this class. There's many books that are written in the Pagra Pseudepigrapha. They're not part of Tanakh. There's many different reasons why they perhaps are not. At the end of the day, they are not part of Tanakh. We don't read them for religious values. We don't look at them as books of inspiration, but at the same time, they have in certain ways or another contributed or do have what to teach us about Judaism that can be helpful. And so, well, I don't necessarily say that everyone should go out and buy a copy and start reading them. It is worthwhile to know what they are and to appreciate why they're not part of Tanakh, but at the same time, the certain things that we do gain from them. I want to take this time to, first of all, tell you that next week we're not going to have class. We're just going to take a one-week break. We're going to then do the next three Wednesdays after that. We're going to be looking at, not exactly sure what the order is yet, but we're going to be looking at the Book of Josephus, we're going to be looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls, we're going to be looking at Megillat Tanit, again, for similar types of things, to know what they are, who wrote them, and ultimately what impact they had on Judaism. If you haven't signed up for Tanakh Sron B'Shanah, it's forms outside. Sign up tonight. Okay.